Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, how to think about corporate responsibility. And Richard, we turn to this topic today because of a document that was recently issued by the Business Roundtable, which is an alliance of major CEOs. And this document was entitled Statement on the Purpose of a Corporation. And this document is sort of in conversation with a famous Milton Friedman article that appeared in the New York Times Magazine back in the early 70s that was very influential in shaping how people thought about the social responsibilities that corporations have. So before we even turn to the Business Roundtable piece, why don't we just start with that context? Why don't you explain for us Milton Friedman's views on this and why they have been so powerful over the past 50 years or so?
Well, Milton has a certain characteristic which I both admire and fear. He is able to take the central thesis that he puts forward with a great deal of power and tends to submerge the qualifications. So the thesis which makes sense only makes true sense in the event that the qualifications are observed. And the thesis that he puts forward at this is the sole purpose of a corporation is to make money for its shareholders, as much money as it possible can. And the qualifications, of course, are in many cases every bit as important as everything else. And these qualifications go to such issues as, well, when you want to make money like this, you have to observe the law. So it's not as well for you to go out and say that I'm going to make money for the corporations by cheating somebody else, by breaching my own fiduciary duties to other parties. What he wants to say is the fiduciary duties only take place nested in a larger structure, and that larger structure is one that is defined by the positive law. So if the positive law is something that you don't like, you can't reform it. In this particular context, if, for example, you, like Milton, think that the minimum wage laws are a terrible idea, you can't run your corporation in a way that violates those particular laws and tries to do something else. The second thing I think that's important to understand about Milton, he was not against any kind of gifts outside the corporation, and there were two ways in which you have to think about this. One of them is corporations are always in the goodwill business. And so what you really want to do under these circumstances is to find a way in which you can make sure that when you have a corporation, it is going to work in a fashion in which it can continue to have all sorts of very useful arrangements with other sorts of people. And the only way in which you can do that, of course, is to maintain goodwill. Sometimes the way in which you maintain goodwill is you take old equipment and you give it to schools and things like that. You can't sell it worth a dime, and the goodwill is probably worth more than whatever residuals that you can get. And Milton was very much in favor of those kinds of things. The question is how far you go with goodwill is something I think you have to worry about, but it's certainly not the case that you're building goodwill when you take a valuable asset of the corporation and give it away free to its internal executives or something of the sort. So that's something which, in fact, you always have to be aware of. The other thing that Milton thought, and I think he's right about this as well, is that when you're trying to figure out where charity comes, what happens is individual shareholders have very diverse views as to the kinds of things they want to support and how they want to support them. And so the trick is if each shareholder gets profits from the corporation, whether in the form of dividends or capital gains or something of the sort, he or she can make a separate decision as to which particular things to support, and you don't get yourself into the incredible conflict interest where a corporation is going to support this political cause or that political cause, where some of them, in fact, are quite hostile to what's going on. And so all in all, what Milton has is a bunch of constraints around that, but he doesn't think, and this is the key point, that when you have your trading partners, your suppliers, your customers, your employees, and so forth, your communities, that you owe fiduciary duties to them. The duties of trust, the only ones you owe it to are the shareholders. They are passive investors in your business, and unless you take extra care of them, they can easily be turned off and won't make investments. If you're dealing with employers, they have union representatives. If you're dealing with suppliers, they know what they're doing. And so the basic model is you have one set of fiduciary duties, and everything else is an arm's length transaction where you hope the gains from trade will take place. I basically believe that that is, in fact, the correct model if you flesh it out in the way in which I've just done.
All right. So let's move on then to the actual Business Roundtable statement. It has been controversial for a number of reasons, one of them being that it's sufficiently opaque that it's turned into a kind of a Rorschach test, and there's a wide variety of interpretations of just how far this statement was deviating from the Milton Friedman principle. So tell us what they said and how you read the trajectory of this.
The ambiguities associated with this particular text are from the ways in which its various parts fit together. The opening sentence is a kind of resounding endorsement of the free market system as the best way in which to supply goods and services that all Americans need and will leave it to a higher level of prosperity. That's all to the good. But then what they do is they list a series of stakeholders, not shareholders, to whom everybody has the same thing. So they want it to be good by all underscored share stakeholders. Who are the stakeholders? These are the customers, these are the suppliers, the employees, and the communities. Well, there are two ways in which you could try to be nice to them. One of them is to simply be honorable in the way in which you do your business. You don't lie, you don't cheat, but you bargain hard with them. And if that's the way in which this thing is going to work, it's not inconsistent with anything Milton wanted to say. But it seems pretty clear when you look at the document, they seem to think that you've got to go some extra mile on this thing above and beyond supplying competitive wages and good services. It is not, of course, in a 300-word document to explain exactly how it is that you're supposed to go beyond all of this. So what then happens is you start to see the two interpretations. Some people say nothing much is going on here. Jim Copeland of the Manhattan Institute took just that line in a very nice piece in the Washington Post. But if you listen to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and many left-wing commentators, they say, well, of course, this means that the corporations have to be out in front on climate change. It means that they have to support strong minimum wage laws. It turns out that what they have to do is they have to aid their communities in all kinds of public works one way or another. They have to give release times to their employees so they can do charitable endeavors. And that list, that cornucopia, can go pretty much on forever. And then you start to say, well, I mean, if I'm in favor of the helping all my stakeholders, am I really in favor of a minimum wage? My view is you want to hurt workers, put a high minimum wage in there. And so then you're going to have a battle. If you've got extra duties to shareholders, exactly what are the, or stakeholders, what they are and how you discharge them. And that gets you into the entire debate between the left and the right as to whether or not a market system works. And certainly with the kinds of things that are suggested by Sanders and others are profoundly anti-market type situation. And then, of course, there's always the externality problem. Your fiduciary duties don't allow you to create nuisances to everybody else, but do these duties to the public at large now require you to make huge investments in trying to reduce the total amount of carbon emissions that you have below those that are required by law? Where again, there's the same question. Are you sure that this stuff is going to do any good? I'm deeply skeptical about it. Others are in favor of it. And so one of the problems about this stakeholder mentality is that there is no substantive agreement as to what those extra duties should look like and how they should be discharged. And so it's that debate which is starting to take place, and it's leaving a lot of people very unnerved on both sides of the argument.
So here's one of the critiques of the business community coming from inside the business community. So let me read to you an excerpt from Tom Wilson, who's the CEO of Allstate. He wrote this in the New York Times. And he's not disavowing the importance of profits here, but he's arguing that the pursuit of profits leads corporations to marginalize a lot of factors that are important to the broader society, like, for instance, the supply of jobs. So here's Wilson in the Times, quote, "Raising the minimum wage for existing jobs will certainly help, but some jobs simply do not create enough value to be high paying. More jobs with higher sustainable wages are needed. This need is going to increase over the next decade as automation and artificial intelligence affect every job in America. Many jobs will be eliminated or made less valuable, putting downward pressure on wages. When I ask my peers whether they consider this an important issue for society, they emphatically say yes. When I ask them whether they discuss this at board meetings, they say no. The blame for this inconsistency is usually placed on investors' demands for profits," close quote. So in other words, we don't think about the right thing because we're too busy thinking about the profitable thing. What's your reaction to that?
I think, in effect, if he's trying to run a corporation, he should run it exactly the way he does. If you're worried about whether or not skills are given available to people, you don't do that through the corporation in any direct way. You have to be able to improve the educational systems, and that means you start thinking about charter schools as opposed to public schools, and you get back to the old debate again. Well, if you really think that public schools are better than charter schools, you're going to take one view. If you think it's the other way around, you're going to take another. Why a corporation Constitution has a special say in that kind of debate, I cannot say. I do think, in effect, that there are some things that corporations should do, but these are perfectly consistent with Milton. Every time you put a restraint on the way in which you can start to hire employees, what you do is reduce the number of employees that are going to be hired and the wages that they get. And so I think it is absolutely incumbent, if you're trying to get a workforce that moves, that what you do is you get rid of all of these constraints that take place in labor markets. So to give you, I think, a point, if you ask who it is who's sighing crocodile tears over the low growth in wages, it's all the progressives during the Obama years, where these wages did not move at all. If you're trying to figure out somebody like Trump, you know, he kind of has his usual callous and coarse way of talking about these things, but he's backed off on the enforcement mechanism. And for the first time, wages at the bottom of the scale are starting to rise very sharply, and teenagers and minority student members and low-skilled people are actually getting real wages. So I think, in effect, the answer is, if you're a corporation, what you should be going out there is not plumping for a higher minimum wage. You should be out there plumping for a lower minimum wage on the grounds that that will, at least if you're in that line of business, allow you to get work. So again, and it's the same little puzzle. These other people, they are very much in favor of stakeholders, and they seem to know exactly what it is you're supposed to do to help them. And in the most cases, what they want to do are the same kind of progressive type things, which I don't think ever work, and one ought to stoutly resist them. And what the Friedman model does is it gives you a very strong ground on which to impose that kind of resistance by preventing corporate boards from moving outside their areas of competence. What it is that the head of Allstate knows that makes him an expert on education or automation beats me. I'm an academic. I'm supposed to know these things. The first thing you know when you're an academic is how little you know about somebody else's business, and you really ought not to intervene. The problem about businessmen, they're used to running lots of boards. They often think that they really can do this thing better than they can.
One of the arguments that you've heard a lot in recent years, Hillary Clinton made it repeatedly and explicitly throughout the course of her presidential campaign, is that one of the reasons that we need to sort of reset corporate America is because it has a real problem with short-termism, or what she used to call this quarterly capitalism. So let me read you. This is what she said about this during the campaign. I'm eliding a few parts of this to try and keep it concise, but nothing that alters her meaning. This is the quote. "The result is too little attention to the sources of long-term growth, research and development, physical capital, and talent. Net business investment, which includes things like factories, machines, and research labs, has declined as a share of the economy. In recent years, some of our biggest companies have spent more than half their earnings to buy back their own stock and another third or more to pay dividends. That doesn't leave a lot left to raise pay or invest in the workers who made those profits possible or to make the new investments necessary to ensure a company's future success. These trends need to change. And I believe that many business leaders are eager to embrace their responsibilities, not just to today's share price, but also to workers, communities, and ultimately to our country and indeed our planet. I'm not talking about charity. I'm talking about clear-eyed capitalism. Many companies have prospered by improving wages and training their workers that then yield higher productivity, better service, and larger profits," close quote. So this is subtly different than the argument we just considered, which was thinking too much about profits gets in the way of your social responsibility. This is, we've actually created a series of perverse incentives because CEOs are focused on the short term, which leads them to think about profits incorrectly. And there's no real trade-off here, or at least not a big one, between profitability and social responsibility, because by paying higher wages, by giving more expansive benefits, you'll actually be more profitable in the long run anyway. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a lot of mumbo jumbo, and let me see if I can break it out. The first thing is, let's suppose, and I think this is often the case, that you will get a better firm if you have higher wages in order to get more productive labor. What you do is you increase the wages by 10, you increase total productivity by 20, and so you've divided the gains evenly. You don't have to pass a law to get people to do that. All you have to do is to make sure that when these people run their businesses, they know what their marginal benefits and their marginal costs turn out to be. What is going to be the kind of thing that's going to stop that is, in fact, the kinds of dangers that you get associated with investments, or rather with regulations on investment, which make it very, very difficult to discharge these things, including hiring workers. So if you want to train workers, one of the optimal strategies for training them is you take them on at below standard minimum wage laws, you pay them in the form of education rather than in form of cash, and then they get a higher wage going forward. Now, you have to make sure that when you train them in this particular fashion, position. They're going to stay with you. And in order to do that, what you have to do is to enter into a kind of bargain which says, we'll send you off to college for 4 years, and you will have to pay the tuition. You will take out a loan. And for each year after your graduation that you stay, we will pay off 25% of that loan. So if you stay with us for 4 years, you get the education for free. Companies do that all the time. They don't need her to explain why it is. So there is no reason there. The question about short-termism in the market, you know, one of the things that happens is the people who are buying are often professional traders. If you're a professional trader in the shares, you obviously want to know about whether or not there's a short-term profit or loss. But no serious analyst simply looks at the statement of current income and says, hey, this is all that I need to know. So take a pharmaceutical company. The first thing an analyst will do is say, what drugs do you have in the pipeline? What are the costs and the probabilities of getting them through? What are the likelihoods of return? And so when you hear somebody saying, well, we don't like the way Pfizer looks today, they're not looking at current income. They're looking at the pipeline. And then Pfizer says, oh, we have this problem. And then they go out and make an acquisition of a company which seems to have a good set of pipeline drugs. So analysts are always looking at the long run under these circumstances. And it would really be silly to assume that they're not. So what she's doing is she's thinking about the naive trader who doesn't know what one way or another. They don't really matter. The huge volume of trades come through mutual funds, and those funds are run by very sophisticated investors. The third thing she says is just 100% wrong. She somehow or other assumes that the companies are not investing. What they're doing is they're giving it through buybacks and dividends. Let's suppose that that's true. One of the things that you have to ask yourself is why are they making this distribution? The money, once it goes out, is not going to just disappear down a rat hole. It's not going to be used for a giant potlatch. The people who get this money back will decide if they've gotten a return of capital. Maybe they'll invest in some other kind of firm. And so what a firm is saying to you when it has lots of cash and it makes a distribution is, we think we're a mature business. We think that if we return the money to you, we can, in effect, allow you to make a new investment which will have a higher rate of return than the one that we're in. And so the key issue in this particular issue, what's going to be the rate of capital gains taxes that you're going to impose upon these things? Because if you impose high capital gains taxes, high dividend taxes, and so forth, then you won't get the realignment of capital. So all of these things which she denounces are things that you actually want to see happen, because it indicates that you can take money from established businesses, get it out, and put it into startups, which have a higher risk and a higher rate of return profile. And as we know, if you're trying to figure out 10 years from now where most of the gain is going to come, it's not going to come from mature companies doing a little bit better by being a little bit bigger. It's going to come from new startups who happen to manage to go from a couple hundred thousand a year to a couple of million, maybe to a couple of billion. And so I think, in effect, this is exactly what's wrong, is that people think they know enough about to interfere with these processes, but all they're doing by this kind of stuff is they're making things worse. There are lots of difficulties associated with capital markets. Most of them come from regulation. They don't come from short-termism or from excess dividends and so forth. And that's the thing that one has to understand. So I've worked on many cases, for example, where, like, for example, the Qualcomm case that I've been closely involved with, you get the FTC bringing a very powerful antitrust action, which has the capability of destroying billions of dollars in damage in value by imposing all sorts of duties that ought to never be imposed. And so I think, again, what you have to understand is the regulatory side is where most of the gains and most of the trades have to be made. It's not on the Milton Friedman model.
So while we're on this topic, we should perhaps close by noting one of the other ways that this impulse is being channeled, namely corporate governance. Elizabeth Warren has a pretty sweeping plan in which she'd sort of cut out the middleman here. She doesn't want to just reorient boards so that they're thinking about the whole world of stakeholders. She wants the stakeholders to have seats on the board. What does a world where something like that happens look like?
There was a great – I wrote a little article about this denouncing her response, and there was a wonderful cartoon by Barbara Kelly, an extremely gifted illustrator. And what she did is she showed this cable with a polyglot group of individuals of one kind or another, and there was somebody standing puzzled at the head, and the thing just kept on going – on and on and on. And the whole point about this is you make a board that big, it becomes clumsy, it can't be decisive. If they represent different kinds of interests, they don't have the expertise in the way in which the firm works. So the whole thing turns out to be Calamity Jane. What you really have to understand about that modest proposal, it's an effort to nationalize corporations. And the total loss in value that comes from that is simply enormous and inexcusable. It's just one of these classic illustrations where you can do the dumbest things by assuming that you could find a weakness and then correct it. Who is going to appoint these directors? To whom do they owe fiduciary duties? Can you give information, for example, about confidential processes to unions so that they can then use it to bargain against people? Can you give this information to local towns so they can hold you up when it turns out that you want to leave? You cannot have a board of trustees with conflicting interests. The level of naivete associated with that proposal is absolutely astounding. I mean, Miss Warren is supposed to be a Harvard law professor. She is absolutely at the peak of total ignorance about how these businesses work, and her proposals are long-term prescriptions for disaster.
All right. Thank you, Richard. Thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.